Hey everyone, and welcome back to season two of the Good Money Podcast, a show brought to you by the awesome human beings of CAPE, an expense management platform helping businesses cut wasteful spending and the time taken on financial admin tasks so they can take control of their cash flow. For those of you joining us for the first time, I'm your host, Ryan Edwards Pritchard, and I'm here to bring you up close and personal with financial leaders from some of the world's most exciting startups and scale-ups that are changing the way we all think about the role of finance and sustainability in business. Today, I'm super excited to be sitting down virtually with none other than John Toth, the CFO of Koala. Koala is a great Aussie startup taking on the gigantic homeware industry with their sustainably focused furniture, hyper-personalized to the busy lives of their customers, whilst also being laser focused on doing wonders for our planet. John, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate you having me on.
Hey, not a problem. Thank you for making time. First of all, just from whereabouts in Australia are you? Because I think I sense a little bit like myself here, a non-Australian accent. I'm assuming you're in the country?
I am. I was very fortunate to meet a woman from Melbourne. Who's my wife, and so I live in Melbourne now. I'm originally from, or we came from San Francisco. A lot of people think of me as a New Yorker, though.
There we go. Casual case of mistaken identity for your troubles of being an East Coaster rather than a West Coaster. How long ago did you actually move over then?
I left New York about 3 days before the real big COVID outbreak 2 years ago. So unbeknownst to us, left just before the pandemic hit. So I've been in Melbourne, been in Australia about 2 years, but I feel like I don't know it yet because so much, particularly in Victoria, has been during the lockdown.
I can definitely empathize with that from a timeline perspective. I actually landed in Australia at the end of 2019, so had a pretty short window of being able to travel around some of the East Coast and New Zealand, in fact, and then had a 24-month window, largely locked away in Sydney, right? I think like we all had. So I've only recently been able to start adventuring around some more outside of New South Wales. Actually made it down to Melbourne a couple times, which I've loved from a cultural perspective, as it really does remind me of home in Europe. And even actually as far as Hobart to check out the Mona Museum recently, which was absolutely epic. Highly, highly recommend if you get a chance. So aside from the day job, John, how is Melbourne life treating you? You've been busy exploring your new home city.
I got a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old who are the best part of my every day. And so you try and time things around the kids' schedule. I'm thrilled that my 10-year-old son can play basketball now, and he's learning footy and all kinds of great stuff. And all of that activity is back on. And so I'm a professional chauffeur half the time.
Yeah, we've got a lot of parents in the Cape team, and there is a long-running joke that they feel like glorified Uber drivers for their kids. Just to change it up a gear and moving on to your startup journey, what attracted you into this space? And also, just talking from your experience, what are your thoughts around when scaling businesses should start thinking about having a full-time CFO?
Sure. I'll do my best to give something that's helpful. I don't particularly enjoy talking about myself. I've been very fortunate to work with some great people. I don't think early stage companies really need CFOs. I think when you start a company, it's really about revenue and proving out the product or service works, and you don't really need a CFO. You need a cash manager, tax, that kind of stuff. And I've been a public company CFO before, and being a CFO who administers a mature company is less appealing to me. What I really enjoy is building something. And most recently, I was with Bark, which we took public on the New York Stock Exchange about a year ago. I joined that company when it was $30 million in revenue. It'll do about $600 this year. And that growth is really fun for me because in that steep part of the S-curve, if you will, that's where a CFO can really add value in architecting the P&L and developing the lenses by which you dashboard and run the business to really add value in the role. I'm a recovering investment banker. First 15 years of my career were investment banking in New York, and I was sort of one of those guys. I did M&A, equity capital markets, debt capital markets, a terrific training ground for financial analysis and solving business problems with finance. And then I became a CFO about 15 years or so ago. And operationalizing finance to me is really fun because that's where you create value. And if you can find an opportunity like Koala, where you're fortunate to work with great people like Mitch Taylor, Danny, really smart, thoughtful entrepreneurs who combine the business with a mission to do the industry better, to make it circular, to divert waste from landfill. That's a really great opportunity to be a part of. So I'm very fortunate to be here.
That BARC journey sounds incredible. $30 million to $600 million, a 20x growth over, in fact, how many years was that? Was that a five-year period?
About 6 years, yeah.
6 years. And just for anybody that isn't aware, are you able just to provide a bit of background in terms of, the name should say it all, but what is BARC?
BARC is in the happiness business, if anything. It is a monthly subscription for dog toys, treats, food, for your pet. The founders of that company, Matt, Carly, and Henrik, brilliant. Matt Meeker is sort of a triple threat. He's very smart, high integrity, very good guy. And he realized about 10 years ago when he founded the company that people were treating dogs as part of the family. And you could see it in terms of how dogs were adopted, percent of discretionary income spent on dogs, services provided. And so BARC became the monthly subscription to enjoy time with your dog and get it healthier products. And it's just been a really great experience to grow the company and take it through the different cycles and be part of that team. Very fortunate.
Now, from a startup perspective, I love the adoption of a subscription model in such a traditional industry. But from a personal perspective, I couldn't agree more about the importance of dogs in your life. You know, we've got a open door policy at Kate when it comes to dogs. I've got a 100-pound rescued Alaskan Malamute who is a very important part of my life. So he makes a fair amount of appearances when it comes to, you know, joining me in the office, which is just awesome. As I always find, you know, furry companions can really brighten up your day no matter what is actually going on. But one thing from a cultural perspective I've come to appreciate about Australia in particular is that it's a real dog-loving society. And just for any of our listeners out there that are also happen to be dog owners, keen to check out BARC, whereabouts are they actually operating from? Are they over here in Australia as well?
States and Canada. We offered product in Australia to test it out, got really good feedback. Need to scale it up, but it's primarily US and Canada.
Cool. That's some great geographies to be focused on. Actually, with the flagging of the states, something that I was really keen to pick your brain on today was just the macroeconomical outlook. And specifically as a leader of the finance division of a scaling business, whether that be BARC or Koala, just the importance of having a deep understanding of how both the private and public markets have evolved. As it goes without saying that doing your due diligence to understand the depth of challenges that you may face as a CFO is obviously imperative. But unfortunately, when issues arise like the market volatility we've seen over the past couple of months, you may not be able to solve all the problems right away. And what we're hearing from our community of finance leaders is that being able to work out how you adapt is imperative. and collaborating with your team and the wider teams, you know, being highly communicative, both up and down the chain, and talking to your board and internal and external investors frequently, you know, looks to be a must, not a nice to have, so that they're never surprised by what's coming. And in those uncertain times, the finance leader and or the CFO, whoever it might be, is one of the most important roles in the business, you know, just given the sphere of influence, which literally touches the entirety of the organization and equally all the investors. That's why oftentimes you see the CFO having a huge impact with investors, yeah, because she or he is the one who has the numbers. She or he has budgeted and drilled down the models and can tell you through the shocks what they've taken on to get through to your base case or your bull case or your bear case, as we talk about in CAPE. You know, that's the kind of three scenarios that we look at when we're looking through our own modeling. And I think that kind of transparency is just what investors want to see. But given a lot of our audience is right now looking at fundraising plans, looking at the markets, you know, and given these kind of economical, the backdrop, I guess, the macroeconomical outlook, as somebody such as yourself, John, who's been through the public markets process to raise funding previously, I wondered what advice you'd have for anyone looking at this journey from a financial, operational perspective, and equally from the perspective on how to construct your team for that journey when looking at the public markets.
It's much more rigorous in the US than on the ASX. The lesson learned, which I was very fortunate to observe at the time, is work with people smarter than you are. I had a phenomenal VP of finance, a great head of accounting, and we had planned for public company readiness starting about 2 years before we went. And the earlier you start that work, the less rushed it is when you get up close and personal to the event, and the more you can embed the controls, compliance, and reporting requirements into the organic workings of the company, as opposed to slamming them on at the end and disrupting operations. So for me, the lessons are hire great people. You're only as good as the people you work with, and start early and incrementally, so that you're not trying to slam it all into place at the last minute.
Yeah, couldn't agree more to that. A leader is only as good as the team, right? You just need to be so cognitive when you're taking that bottom-up approach to reach a final end goal, like a public listing. It's going to involve all the members of the team working together in unison to reach the necessary outcomes. And without the individual skill sets of each different team member, you know, reaching that pinnacle can be near impossible. And if you've hired well, as you say, you trust your team, you empower them, you cheer them on, and you support them through those endeavors, then there's no doubt you'll get to the promised land. You know, whatever that is, or whatever the you know, to use the metaphor, but you know, the mountain you're climbing together is, right? Just with that particular journey in terms of listing, what was the evolution of the finance team over that you know, couple of years that you were there as you guys scaled at Bark? And how also did your role within there as a CFO change over that period?
We were, when I started that, so I was with the company for about 6 years. You know, when you work with growth companies, you go through a series of transitions. The first, often the finance team really is a bookkeeping team to manage cash and keep the books. And at some point you evolve into an accounting team for accrual accounting. You evolve your system from QuickBooks or Xero, and you tend to move it into a more enterprise system like NetSuite or Microsoft Dynamics. The In general, I see the CFO's job has a defensive function and a constructive function. Defensively, you have to close the books, you have to pay the taxes, you have to pay your vendors. But what I say to my teams is you can do the best tax return in the world, and what will it do for the margins of the company? What will it do for the share price? Nothing. So you have to size that effort for the value it's going to provide for the business. Where finance gets constructive is on the FP&A side, the financial planning analysis, when you partner with decision makers and you get out ahead of the decisions. I think where, you know, when finance comes from an accounting perspective, it tends to focus on historicals, which is driving through the rearview mirror, if you will. Where finance really adds value is when you start working with leading indicators for business performance. And then you can meet with different department heads and tell them where they're going based on current trends and talk about ideas to avoid the pitfall we're headed for or to take advantage of the opportunity we see ahead. Where I think finance adds value is when you get out ahead of that decision, which is a trick, but that separates sort of an accounting team from a finance team, if you will.
Love that explanation of the evolution from bookkeeping, accounting to FP&A. I don't think I've actually come across somebody who's explained it so succinctly. So nice. Just to delve a bit deeper into the public markets piece and the macroeconomical environment, because I do find it fascinating, especially given your background, and looking obviously at the journey that we've all been on in the last couple of years with various government interventions to push interest rates basically down to zero in most Western economies, actually. Some market spectators and economists have, I guess, speculated that this was a cause for what they've seen as overfunding in the equity asset class. Hence, we've seen equity valuations change dramatically over that period, and in particular in 2021. We've all seen the graphs out there. Then we've seen, a repricing of those valuations this year, as they've come back to what looks to be their 2020 val, as we've then seen kind of major capital adjustments in the equities market. Putting all that aside, we've also seen the Ukraine war breakout, which has triggered an acute inflation in oil prices. And we've also seen changing consumer confidence. Just with everything that's going on, what's your take on the public markets and the macro themes that we're seeing play out right now?
I think we're going through a two-step right now. The first is the stimulus from COVID is over, and interest rates are going up. And the problem is I'm old. I wish I wasn't, but I've seen this movie before, which is when interest rates go up, or let me say it differently, when interest rates are essentially zero, then money managers, the mega money managers, get no return out of the debt side of their portfolio. And so they arguably overfund equities. And that's why, and so there's increased supply of cash chasing equities. And that's why you see market multiples hit historic highs. You see high valuations for high growth, high cash burn companies. You see more funding for high risk equities. And we were fortunate to be in that position for the past at least 5 years or so. When interest rates start going up, then money, again, the mega multi-hundred billion dollar money managers start allocating funds to debt because they can get a return from debt. And so you see the money supply retreating from the higher risk portions of equity. Private equity, more speculative IPOs, you see that valuation adjustment. So the first step we're going through right now to me is an equity valuation adjustment. There's just less money available for equity. you're seeing the more risky or the fringier equity opportunities suffer the most. And we're seeing that valuation repricing and a change in capital availability for private companies seeking equity. That's very much a capital adjustment that's happening. The second step that I think we're all looking for, holding our breath, watching, is the consumer response to inflation. The capital response to inflation is to raise interest rates. The consumer response is going to be in spending. Gas prices are going up. All kinds of prices are going up. Will the consumer change their discretionary spending habits? That's what companies like Koala and other consumer companies that we need to watch for and be ready for. So those are some of the macro themes I'm very focused on in making sure that the Koala is well positioned to address.
Yeah, the markets are a pretty scary place right now. There's a lot of folks losing sleep over everything that is happening as we look at entering a bear market. And just to add to your points before, you know, with CAPE as a payments and financial services business, we've been tracking the macro trends from across GDP growth rates to inflation to the general lending performance in Australia quite closely as we prepare for their impact on the company, on CAPE. You know, one of the key areas you just touched on is consumer spending. You know, for us, it's a super relevant indicator since payments facilitation and credit card issuance is such a big part of our business. With inflation and recession looming, consumer and corporate spending could be impacted, especially for larger purchases. You know, durable goods, incidentally, we find tend to be high signal to noise macro indicators, which is a key input for our forecasting model. Just given your background and lens, you know, the time of you joining Koala couldn't be any more important to help them steer the ship when it comes to driving down their operating costs and improving the overall operating leverage by increasing top line revenue. And yeah, that's clear. That's obviously something you can bring to the table. But it is a lot of responsibility to take on your shoulders. So I do doff my cap to you. And just bringing the kind of conversation back to Koala and the challenge, you know, that you're taking on. You know, how long ago did you actually first meet the crew over there? And what was it about the founders and the collective unit that drew you over to join them during this period?
So maybe 3 months ago, 3.5 months ago, I met Mitch, and I also met Danny with Milk Run. And then I joined a little less than 2 months ago. The older you get, the more you realize working with good people makes all the difference in the world. And, you don't get better than Mitch. He's smart. He's a good person. He cares. He's nimble. All great things. And so love working with entrepreneurs who look at the world and see how it should be different. All things being equal, the world doesn't need another furniture company. But Mitch and Danny conceived of a vision and are executing something that truly solves the customer problem. The customer doesn't just want a bed. They want the old bed taken away. They want the new bed brought. They want it assembled and available when they want it. They don't want to wait 2 months for a couch or a bed. They want to be able to buy it, have it delivered, have it assembled, enjoy it, be comfortable, and the old bed taken away. And they don't want it to go in the landfill. Koala has set itself up to, we have free and fast delivery. You can get the bed within 4 hours if you want it. It's super product, man. If you hear James Whitta and his team talk about a product and the level of thought and integrity that goes into building these B beautiful pieces of furniture that are environmentally friendly, sustainable, and recyclable. When you talk with Mark Mitchison, who runs our product recovery center, we take old product, we refurbish it for resale or donation. And again, we're creating a circular company here, truly, that solves the customer's problem. And we're part of what I consider, you know, the Web 3.0 or direct-to-consumer 2.0. One of the things I'm always struck with is brick-and-mortar retailers really don't know the consumer. They don't have information on them. They don't know them well. When you're direct-to-consumer, you get to know why the customer wants a bed. Do they want it because the dog ate the old one and they have to get a new mattress? Or are they moving? Are they moving in with somebody? And when you know that information, you can meet the customer's problem in a way that just a Amazon or a marketplace doesn't. And I get really excited about the opportunities of this more relationship or conversational commerce that is created. And the market for furniture is enormous. And the opportunity to do it in a better way than it's being done today, a more sustainable way, is huge, and it's what the consumer wants. So it's a terrific opportunity, and I wish I could take credit for it, but these guys have built a terrific company.
Yeah, fair play to them. What do we all do on a daily basis? Go from our last episode with Who Gives a Crap to our next episode with Koala. Well, you know, we all need to sleep, and we all need somewhere comfortable to sleep. And I think we're all a lot more conscientious in terms of how that product is actually brought to life. So I could definitely see the movement. Just out of interest, in terms of Mitch and Danny, because I was reading before, originally based in Byron Bay, well, founded back in 2015. Is the HQ still there, or have they actually moved it since?
The headquarters is in Sydney.
Headquarters in Sydney, you're based in Melbourne, mm-hmm. And assume, are you hybrid in terms of your working style?
I am. I try and come weekly, or at least every other week.
Nice. Makes sense. And just on the team piece, what's your full-time headcount across Australia, Japan, and Korea? And then how does that actually break down into revenue pools across the different geographies?
There's more opportunity out there. We're over 200 employees at this time.
That's a strong headcount. Just given these aren't your home nations and you've only recently launched the international operations, would it be fair to assume that revenues are lagging the home Australian market?
No, Japan is much more advanced. Korea's early days for us.
Well, huge congrats to the Koala team in that case. As internationalized in your operations, when you have to overcome language and culture barriers, is not easy. And Japan and Korea are pretty intimidating on the face of it. It's something I had to overcome actually in Europe, which consists of 44 countries, 24 different languages, when it came to scaling my last startup across the continent. And now with Cape, you know, we're looking at the APAC region. It's home to close to 2,200 languages and across 13 countries, which is just mind blown. So it throws up all sorts of complexities and costs when it comes to translating a product into all those different geographies and languages, as well as considering customer support in the native languages. Yeah, so for Cape, it's all about considering those elements, as well as the regulatory environment, as well as understanding the plug and play technology providers in, say, the payments space, to be specific. Obviously, moving from a fintech product like Cape to a physical product like Koala, which needs to be constructed and transported, how are you viewing market sizing and the growth opportunities for Koala in terms of geographic and product expansion so that you can customize your products to fit the cultural norms of those different regions? I got to say, I'm a big fan of the messaging and position of Koala. I think what you're doing and building from an overall ethical lens when considering your approach to sustainability and environmental elements is just fantastic. And I can see how and why that resonates with different audiences. I guess from an internationalization perspective, the other side of things is just the whole cultural market fit within those different demographics. You know, you need time to consider the expectations and nuances of engaging with potential local customers such as the Japanese and Korean millennials and Gen Zs, and need to overlay those considerations with how do you test your proposition within those target audiences if you're not yet ready to hire local employees or have that local presence. So historically, that's where, you know, I think running with product teams around and growth teams, running fake door A/B tests has been really popular. Yeah, and a way to go out there utilizing some of the advertising platforms like Facebook and Google in particular to see what data comes back before you start making serious investments into those different territories. And from there, and with a series of more qualitative interviews and research, you can then really start to delve into some of the trickier things ahead of an actual launch. So you can start to understand what the local business customs might be. And how do they differ from the more, I guess, laid-back approach we take to business in Australia? Things like whether our lingo and slang words land in a new market or be the source of confused looks and even potential offense, as that can happen somewhat commonly and far too easily. You know, on that customer centricity piece we were talking about before, and just understanding a local market like Japan, I was fortunate enough to travel around the country just prior to the pandemic, and I can confirm that space is definitely at a premium. And in particular, you know, with Tokyo, everything else feels, let's say, cozy. How's that impacted the design process for Koala? And how have you adapted to the different living conditions in places like, say, Japan and Korea?
I think... Koala will be, certainly has the opportunity, and I think if we do it right, will be a global company. It will always be Australian in its roots, in its DNA, in its product. But I think the opportunity in Japan is huge. We haven't scratched the surface in the US yet or India. I think the way we think about growth is sort of threefold, if you will. One is geographic, that we're talking about now. Two is by room. We started in sleep. We launched our new homewares products this week. And I think the technical term is they're awesome. If you look at our homeware site and our pillows and our blankets and the couches, I guarantee they're just the greatest. And so... we're growing by room. We're growing outside of just the mattress to sleep, to the bedroom, outside the bedroom, to the living room, to the office. And then we also grow by life stage. We have products for uni students, for kids who just got their first job, for kids who now have a partner, for kids who are thinking about having a baby. So you grow with life stages too. So we're very thoughtful about strategically how we position ourselves to grow for the long term and be a global company.
Now, that's a really interesting point, especially from a perspective of cohort analysis, in which, you know, groups of customers you're narrowing your gaze on focusing on. I was reading recently a McKinsey report flagging millennials and Zoomers, as they're now called, are expected to be the two largest consumer groups in Australia, which is largely being propelled by younger immigrants continuing to swell our ranks over here. This obviously counters Japan, which is more known for its aging population. But just kind of one thing, I guess, around that, you know, who are, in that case, Koala's main focus, assuming Gen Xers and millennials, in which case, are you finding that those, with those cohorts, that the more drawn to Koala and their stance that you're taking with the circular economy, and that's a real important point of differentiation in this market?
I think generationally, Gen X is more attuned to businesses need to be truly sustainable. They need to act in an environmentally friendly way. We want to go beyond sustainability to actually enhancing the environment. So I think our message resonates with that generation and younger more. But frankly, we our demographic is very wide. It's a very flat distribution across ages.
Got it. I got to ask the question, but Japan, my God, like that is a fascinating country. I was lucky enough just pre-pandemic to spend a bit of time over there, over in Tokyo and actually the mountains, in fact, over skiing towards Tsukuba. The one thing that definitely became apparent, size of living quarters is, let's describe it as cozy. And I can imagine that probably throws out some challenges when you're focused on building furniture for these different sized units. So how have you guys, and just thinking about the product design framework, and especially you mentioned about customer centricity, how have you gone about that in terms of the localization, or has it been quite a straightforward, because it sounds like there must be so much consideration there.
But that's the opportunity. On the one hand, the challenge, if you sort of roll back the tape, in general, the furniture industry is focused on manufacturing. How long a run can you get out of the manufacturer of that one sofa? The opportunity is, again, as you said, customer centricity, solve the customer's problem. In Japan, space is at a premium. They want smaller and they want multi-use. It's not as valued in Australia. But for example, when you're a direct-to-consumer company and you have information, you have feedback from customers in Japan saying, I need it to be smaller, it needs to fit through my door. I need a pillow that has wood on the back so I can use the pillow as a lap desk for eating or my laptop. And you plug that into your design team. All Koala's products are proprietary. We design our own. So you get that data, you put it in the James's design team. They come out with products that speak to the customer's problem or desire. And so now we have a couch that the side pillows have a wood back, and they're lap desks, but if you put the wood to the back, it's a beautiful sofa. You have guest sleep is not as big an opportunity in Japan. They don't have that extra room. It's a huge opportunity here in Australia and the US, et cetera. But those customizations enable a smart business like Koala to perform. If it was all one size fits all, that's very quickly driving to low-cost convenience, high manufacturing, less of the customization and customer centricity. So I love that there's more data available about specific needs because you can respond to it. And what a great customer experience, which brings them back for more. So very passionate and very much believe that what the web is doing is enabling this much more informed product and service provision than you certainly get from brick and mortar or Amazon or eBay or Rakuten, which are just big marketplaces. If you want pricing convenience, go to Amazon or use your Prime points, find the cheapest, get it. If you want something that fits your need and speaks to your value with delivery and takeaway, that's where we win. And that's what's going to win long term.
Totally agree, and love that you focus on the long-term win whilst clearly understanding the short-term gains that build your momentum to helping you reach that North Star, whatever it might be. Out of interest, John, whether it's been with Bark or Koala, what's your CFO playbook for how the finance function allows for internationalization of new territories and how to go about funding the R&D process of producing new types of products for those geographies? Yeah, and how does speed to market also play into all of this recipe?
For international and new products, I'm a big believer in moving quickly to engage the customer. I think I get, I don't know how to phrase this respectfully, but I think it is a, it's not productive to hire McKinsey to do a study to collect information and design product for what you think. Move fast and get the customer to react. I've seen so many customer surveys done and interpreted different ways and resulted in bad spend because the customer lies, or that's what we would joke, or customer doesn't know how to respond. I'm a very big believer of being nimble, move fast, listen hard to the response you get, the signal you get from the market, adjust, move fast, make lots of small bets, be prepared to fail, but fail quickly and learn and iterate, as opposed to these, you know, very considered, thoughtful exercises that precede introducing a product to the market. Put it in there, get the reaction, listen hard, don't go with prior expectations, don't lead the witness, listen hard to what you're getting and react.
There it is. Listen hard. Surprisingly, all too often an underrated skill for anyone, let alone a founder. That's some great advice, John. Bring things back to the Koala team. When working in the business, you know, with those bookkeeping and accounting functions, and then working on the business with FP&A, internationalization, you know, of your operations, as well as launching a variety of new products, and just to kind of take a look at the as is to the to be here, what's the construct of your finance operations team, both in terms of what you've inherited now, and how do you see that evolving over time?
Oh, I fell out of the lucky tree and landed in a golden pot of rainbow.
Yeah, I think as a leader, it's so important to give your team the right tools they need to succeed. Aside from bringing a refined skill set and years of experience in the coalface to the table, you need to focus your efforts on helping those around you to learn, grow, and gain insight to better their own future and that of the company, whether that be Koala or Cape. But that, my friend, is not a one-way road for a leader going out of their way to develop those around them. It's a two-way road. You know, it needs others to come to the table on their own journey of growth and self-discovery. And just with that in mind, what is your playbook for spotting talent that could be a culture fit or culture add, John?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I'm fortunate to work with Emma Golding, who is our VP of Finance. She's a rock star. She owns and runs FP&A. And S&OP, which is a combination of demand planning, sales, and operations planning. But she does so much more for the company. She's way smarter than I am. And then running the accounting, controls, cash, tax, treasury side, Belinda Judd is awesome. You're only as good as the people you work with, and I'm really fortunate they're way better than I am. That's how we organize ourselves right now.
Nice. And just from your take in terms of not just with Koala, but with Bark and other places, for anybody else that's kind of listening out there, what do you see as making a great finance team in a fast growth startup, in a fast growth scale up? What are the kind of core skills that you believe in that others can take away?
I think one of the big challenges is finding the right person for the environment. And to me, this is a conversation about fit, not whether it's right or wrong or good or bad, but fit. I have, unfortunately, There's a lot of people with terrific resumes from large companies like Woolies or Amazon or eBay or Wesfarmers, you know, big companies, big names, great training grounds that don't fit, that are lousy inside of a fast growth, either startup or scale up. And that's not just for finance, that's for any function. I remember interviewing somebody who said, oh yeah, no, I know how to be scrappy at Amazon. You know, I only had a budget and it was very thin. I had to work with it. Amazon is subsidized by Oz, right? They have this huge cash machine in the background. And you know, there's always a safety net. It's very different in an early stage company. And the analysis you do, the decisions you make have direct impacts on the P&L. One of the things I look for is I ask people why they do what they do, or why they think about it that way. And if the response is, because that's how we did it at XYZ, that's a terrible answer. You got to think about the first principles. We're inventing a new company here. We want to do it smarter and better than anybody else. So I challenge you to think of a better way to do it. I challenge you to improve us beyond what we are today and be entrepreneurial and take that on. And if that's uncomfortable for you, I totally get it. But then an early stage company is not the right place for you. You're better off at a place that has a playbook where you're replacing somebody who had the job for years before and you're replicating what they do. If you want to be creative and you really embrace that, and you can deal with the stress of something that's demanding. This is, you know, you're bush bashing. You're going through an area that hasn't been established before. And you love that. That's great fit. If it's uncomfortable for you, it's not a great fit.
Interesting. With CAPE, we've been focusing on hiring full velocity and building a fast-paced culture. We find it's important to look for people with strong spikes in critical areas. Not only will they enable you to go after your goals, but they'll help create a sense of momentum and actually attract the next set of folks you need to hire. So you're not just hiring that one person, you're actually hiring all the people that either they will bring in or that they'll inspire to come to the company. And so it's just, there's so much leverage in those first few hires, if you can get it right. When I look internally at CAPE, I think one area we've excelled at is our ability to hire, you know, both in terms of diversity with a gender balance that's currently split 40-60 and is moving towards neutrality, and then attracting a number of entrepreneurs and previous founders. You know, over half our team, 30 are former founders. So the other element to this is then also hiring for culture fit and culture add. I think from a culture angle, you know, this is something that a lot of startups struggle with, you know, to just put it into words. I think how we look at it is that it just ultimately comes back to what are our collective values. So instead of throwing values up on the wall and not fully understanding what they mean, the question of values is often trying to get at what actually represents what people would say and what people sincerely feel about our team. You know, a lot of culture is just really what you're about and what you do. And I think that's an important part in terms of how you look for the right type of team members to come in who are based on that kind of culture element and how you champion that internally. Putting the talent piece to an aside for a second, John, what would be your advice to early stage startups looking to improve their financial position, you know, and having to navigate this market as we enter this economical uncertain period?
Boy, we need to get a beer and talk about this because it'll take a long time to get through all my thoughts. But, you know, you've asked advice, if you will, and advice is free, and that's what it's worth, nothing but my response is, I think finance to me is a strategic function, and that means if you perfect the close cycle and the payment cycle, but the company is burning money in this environment, that's a strategic failure. It may be a tactical success in terms of perfecting a process within the company, but finance needs to get out of front, in front of the business, and make sure it has the capital resources to pursue its mission in any environment. And in this environment, it's not a time to be timid. It's not a time to be slow. It's can be a scary time depending on the profile of the business. But the worst thing you can do is move slow. If you need to cut costs, the sooner you cut them, the sooner you get the savings and you can help the business. Don't be afraid of hard messages. If you're afraid of the difficult conversation, it won't happen, or it won't happen with sufficient clarity to help decision makers make better decisions. So my playbook, if you will, is don't wait. Be clear-eyed about the situation you're in. And also, be realistic about the conversations you're having with equity providers. I have a lot of respect for private equity guys and venture capitalists. Very smart. They almost never say no. They just say later, or they ask for more information, or they cite a milestone. And if you're a company that's in a burn position and you walk away from a meeting and say, oh, they just want one more quarter worth of information, recognize that for what it is. It is an unclear signal. It doesn't mean they won't do the deal, but they will never say or very rarely say no flat out. And if you wait, you'll put the company in an adverse position. So the other thing is, the only thing you know for sure about a forecast is it's wrong. It's directional. Don't try and perfect it. Don't put decimal points in it. That implies a level of precision that's just not there. So focus on what's important and the real drivers for the business, not perfecting the details. Those are some of my thoughts. I could talk about this for a long time.
Snap. I find it fascinating to look at. And to take a step back and to look at the backdrop of the bigger picture, more from a macroeconomical perspective, it is interesting to observe that in Australia, unlike a lot of Western economies right now, there's this big gap opening up around consumer sentiment and consumer spending. There's no doubt that consumer sentiment is in the doldrums right now and feeling gloomy. We can thank everything from the interest rates going up, which is seeing the housing market slow down, the war in Ukraine, you know, causing the skyrocketing petrol prices, and then not to mention the cost of lettuce reaching the exorbitant price of $12 a head in Australia. You know, the only people cheering on that news are the smashed avocado lovers out there who suddenly feel smugly justified in the choice of green goods. Anyway, jokes aside, and to get back to the real point here, All the data shows that consumer spending is actually booming, despite that negative backdrop and the way that the media want it to be perceived. CBA actually released some data, some household data, showing it booming all the way through to June. And this spending includes cafes and restaurants, accommodation, and this is across all states in Australia. So sentiment might be depressing to see and hear, but it's what consumers go out and spend in the high street and online that is powering jobs, which is what I think we need to be mindful of. There's a booming labor market with the lowest unemployment rates, you know, which are at a 49-year low. Wage growth looks to be surging ahead as well. So whilst we're feeling downbeat, we're in the middle of the year and there's plenty of retail therapy going on out there. You know, Australians have got the funds at their disposal to spend on those holidays that they haven't been able to enjoy overseas since pre the pandemic. So everything is showing the Australian economy has momentum still in it, even though clearly things will slow in the second half of the year. We can all see and understand that. With all that in mind, and when looking at Koala, you're one of those rare businesses that have been profitable for some time. So I'd assume not necessarily as dependent on equity funding to get you through this period of uncertainty. But with that backdrop of consumer sentiment and spending we just covered, as well as the changing competitive landscape, how are you gearing up the finance function at Koala for this period? Are you looking at it as a period of growing your market share domestically and internationally, or more a period of consolidation?
I love leaning into adverse environments. If in general our competitors will take a breath, pause, that's exactly the time you want to lean in. You need to do that smartly and pick your spots. And I'm very focused on making sure that Koala is balanced if the consumer begins to change their spending profile, reduce their spending profile. That's a very real potential scenario. And different geographies can and will react differently. So we need to be well positioned for any. And as you pointed out, I'd love to take credit for it, but Mitch and Danny were very disciplined about how they constructed the business and how they constructed the unit economics of the business. And unit economics win. If you don't have the right unit economics, there's no amount of cost cutting and overhead that's going to solve that problem. So I'm very focused on making sure we continue that discipline with all our products, that they roll up to the right answer regardless of volume, that we're disciplined on our marketing spend. I think one of the risks now is for companies that have promised large, you know, big growth rates, hyper growth rates to investors, if they see that growth challenged, the first response tends to be put more money into Facebook, put more money into SEO or TV advertising, which will just drive your CAC up if the customer is spending less. So I think you got to be very disciplined in this scenario about making sure your unit economics are correct, whether the unit you're using is the product or the unit is the customer. That's what I'm focused on.
Just a curiosity, just to kind of lean into that point there. So when you say about the it either being the product or the customer, are you talking about it from a CAC versus a kind of CLTV kind of perspective, customer lifetime value?
Well, to me, so LTV to CAC is a cut where customer is the unit. You know, customer acquisition cost, so how much it costs to get that customer in the door, lifetime value of that customer. You can have multiple products sold to that customer, multiple transactions. So in that case, sort of the literal definition, the unit is the customer. Then the other dimension, if that's the horizontal dimension, if you will, the vertical dimension is product. Make sure that the armchair sells at a price that covers its COGS with enough room for freight and shipping and return marketing. And cover G&A. So I think particularly with direct-to-consumer marketing, you need to look at both dimensions of unit economics, both with customer is the unit and product is the unit.
So to delve into this further, when it comes to Koala, the standout unit economics you're looking at are the cost of goods sold, aka COGS, that is the cost of producing the various furniture items, then the distribution costs, that is the cost of getting the furniture to the customer, which with no actual physical stores means it's purely a delivery play. And then I guess the other thing to consider is the general transaction cost. That is the cost of executing transactions for the furniture and providing the customer service that you do. Now, putting my fintech hat on here, though, I guess the one kind of additional point and the one question we all have to ask ourselves is whether we have a sustainable advantage in how much we spend to acquire each customer so that we can achieve ideally as low a customer acquisition cost, aka a CAC, as possible. What we see far too often is that the CAC to LTV, the lifetime value, so the CAC to LTV model ratios are super sensitive to long-term returns and from achieving a low user churn. Hence, you end up seeing established fintechs paying a ton to compete with whoever has the most optimistic assumptions. And ultimately, the lower the CAC and the higher the LTV, the better the unit economics are. In the beginning of any new category or industry, whether that be what Koala is building within the Hope furniture space or Cape is building with B2B spend management, there's always less infrastructure. And for that reason, there's always less competition. The battleground is then really all around the product. Can you actually build the thing you're saying you're building? Then over time, as a category matures and the building blocks become homogenized, the battleground moves to the audience. When anyone can sell some version of the same thing, acquiring customers becomes the hardest part, and differentiation through strong brand awareness and preference becomes more essential, in my honest opinion. It's also ultimately why Google and Facebook make so much money within the startup and scale up and stay ahead of space. As more competitors are vying for the same pool of customers, CAC inherently just goes up, and companies need to either accept a lower CAC to LTV ratio or increase LTV by increasing their prices, cross-selling more products, or just improving customer retention. Now, John, what's your lens when looking at CAC as someone who runs a finance function for a scale-up like Koala and previously Bark?
We do it ourselves. To me, it starts with the decision that CAC is a choice. You can look at CAC as an output of your spend, or you can use CAC as the variable by which you drive. You have a target CAC per week, per sale, per month, per quarter. And when you drive from that perspective, to have that level of sensitivity, you need to control yourself. I think the customer contact from marketing all the way through delivery and customer service fulfillment is your brand. If you delegate that to somebody else, you begin to lose control over your brand. Begin to lose that customer centricity. So sorry to respond with sort of a first principles reaction, but to me, if you take on that customer centricity model to the logical end, you have to own all those points of contact.
Yeah, I don't think any customer-obsessed startup would want to be losing that type of control. And to explore this performance data world of unit economics and customer acquisition costs for just a moment, some might be skeptical about the value in the attribution narratives that you derive from, let's say, touchpoint data when you start to enrich those models with your system of record data that you typically find in your CRM, such as HubSpot or Salesforce. And you can then see how a lead that's come in has interacted with your customer services team all the way through to your account executive team. And later on, when you're looking at the success of accounts, your customer success team. And then you can also just look in prior to the lead itself, whether it's a marketing qualified lead or a sales qualified lead and hasn't yet converted, you can look at the exposure the customer has had to your brand in a variety of formats, both online with, say, banner advertising and offline with billboards or radio so that you can build some type of weight ratioed model with these different touch points. But to achieve that type of insight and en masse, it's a real complex challenge. Hence, a lot of people choose not to even start looking at it. But in a hyper-competitive market, it is a necessity, in my honest opinion. In my last startup, our key product was actually lead generation for small businesses, you know, searching for alternative finance solutions. And over a four-year period, we grew our leads from a standing start of zero requests for business finance per month to 10,000. We wouldn't have scaled our volumes to that if we hadn't had a major rethink of how we predict the success of digital touch points ahead of time, you know, and a campaign you might choose to run with. And now with Kate, which is a B2B customer journey with multiple decision makers, unlike, say, a consumer customer journey when purchasing furniture goods from Koala, we're finding that for most of our customers, the number of digital touch points before, let's say, a finance manager, a financial controller, CFO, or general C-suite decision maker will say, hey, I'd like a demo, is somewhere between 5 and 20. And most are actually around that 10 to 12, but you know, these are business customers. The 20 touch points are important, but they might have clicked on something and spent half a second on that page. So when you build your models, you need to be intentional about how you count those digital touches into it. Now, I believe it's possible to predict the outcome of future campaigns based on past results and that everyone needs to measure marketing. But I would caveat it with that attribution modeling is really hard and complex and feels like a constantly moving target, you know, with how quickly online and offline behavior is currently changing.
Yeah, I have never seen an attribution model that works.
Yeah, we're definitely at the start of a long journey when it comes to attribution modeling. I talk a lot to our team about this mantra of complexity in crawl, walk, run. You know, when it comes to a variety of piece of work that we do, so we don't end up overcooking what should be at times a simple MVP just to get us moving, just to get us testing something. And I think when it comes to startups and scale-ups exploring this space, I'd love to start the journey in that crawling phase with building out some simple models, not getting into the weeds right away. And each of those models you build is ultimately to tell you a different story. A first touch model tells you how you got that customer at the very beginning of the sales cycle. An even spread multi-touch model tells you a bigger story about what happened in the entire sales cycle. You know, and again, that's kind of more into the kind of walking phase. And then a last touch model tells you which of your campaigns is effective just before the customer is filling out a form and are actually saying they want to engage. They don't fill out the form until they're really ready. You know, they don't want to get a call while they're just poking around, for example. The challenge is that prospects who are just poking around often don't identify themselves. So that makes it really hard to identify the content that had a positive impact on the prospect who ultimately converts in the end. You know, I've heard some forward thinkers and tinkerers in the space addressing this challenge by using even extensive firmographic data, which includes business IP addresses that, just for context, is very much moving straight into the running phase. So not to kind of scare anybody out there thinking about this area. Just in terms of your experience, John, what are your thoughts around how to go about multi-touch attribution?
It's not clean cut. I tend to stand on the transaction, and to me, last click is as good as any. You definitely see, you know, if you spend more on Facebook, if you run a large commercial, you see an uplift in all channels. But I get very uncomfortable when the marketing team talks about brand spend. Well, you have a brand to acquire customers. You don't have a brand to be popular. We're not an entertainment company. We have the brand to acquire customers and get transactions. So to me, this idea of brand spend separate from performance marketing is a very dangerous concept. And I tend to focus on last click attribution, understand the customer journey to the transaction, and meet the customer along that journey. And you need to understand how they move through cyberspace and when they go to your website. That's to me where I focus, but I get very uncomfortable when generalized brand spend is talked about. That's a justification for not monitoring the return or productivity in your marketing spend, which gets away from the idea of unit economics entirely.
That's an incredible overview. Thanks for sharing that, John. Just aware of time, and one last thing that I was keen to pick your brain on before we wrap up is this march that we're all on with moving from where we're at as an economy and society in what's described as the industry 4.0 phase, that's simply focused on the automation of tasks with the use of machine learning and real-time data, to industry 5.0 as an era, whenever that might happen, but in the future, where we as humans are all working alongside robots and smart machines. And it's a big shift from focusing on the economical value and general output that's created to the 4.0 phase, to then a focus on more the environmental and societal value. And an overall shift in focus on just the general welfare, you know, of everyone as a human species to meet all of our basic human needs, to actual well-being. Now, manufacturing was at the heart of the Industrial Revolution, and it looks to be playing an important role as we embrace what's coined as the circular economy, which is a focus on reducing material use, redesigning materials to be less resource intensive, and recapturing waste as a resource to manufacture new materials and products. Now, looking into Koala's strategy from your certified B Corp status to your 1% profit for the planet pledge, and then your recent announcement of the Second Home Initiative, you know, you guys, in my eyes, are at the forefront of creating a blueprint for how to build the modern business that's given back to society and here for the long term. For any of our listeners looking to embed any of these initiatives into their own startups and businesses, whilst appreciating you're still relatively new to the team over at Koala, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on how Koala's gone about the process of launching these and how intensive they've been to get off the ground and to manage overall.
Koala is, and I hope to make it more obvious, Koala is a case study for how to do it right. And again, I'm just really fortunate to be a part of that. We're a certified B Corp and have been for 6 years, 1% for the planet. This year, we donated over $6 million of product, over $500,000 for the floods victims in New South Wales. We paid over $3.5 million in cash this year, donations. But you can only do that if the business works. The business is not a charity. And so you have to design the company to be productive and integrate doing the right thing, for lack of a better word, being environmentally sustainable, diverting from landfill. You have to integrate that into the genetic makeup of the operations of the business. You can't absolve yourself of sin just by paying carbon offset credits or buying carbon offset credits. stop using carbon. So Koala takes it very personally, which to me is the pivot that we're going through globally. There was the awareness campaign, and then there was, well, I'm flying to Sydney, so I'll buy some carbon offset credits. We really need to operationalize sustainability. And we're very fortunate to have a talented woman, Hannah Franklin, Frankie, who leads our sustainability or thrivability effort. She works closely with Belinda, again, one of my rock stars. And she is very thoughtfully educating all the departments within the company about what they can do in terms of their job function, and also the performance of the company to really drive sustainability to a very fundamentally productive level. And I don't think that's been done as thoroughly any place I've seen as it is at Koala. And it's really fulfilling. You can really get very passionate about getting behind the mission because we take it. It's part of who we are. It's not an afterthought, which I love.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going through a transition in terms of society as a whole, in terms of questioning how we live our lives, and then equally becoming a lot more demanding, I feel, when it comes to, you know, where we choose to actually part ways with our dollars. You know, we're expecting, you know, businesses to be more conscious of that. And I think, you know, the fact that Koala was so early on that journey, you know, puts the team in such good stead for the future, and really is showing the rest of us how it's done, and really is incredibly inspiring. So John, tell us, for anybody that's interested to know more about Koala, what should they do? Where should they go?
They can email me at j.toth@koala.com. I'm terrible on email. I'm very slow, so apologies in advance. But definitely reach out for Kirk Lines. We have the greatest products ever, and I personally guarantee you, you'd be happy with them. I love them. So please do reach out for me for that.
Amazing. I, my friend, will be hitting you up for some of those coupons. I can't wait to check out what you guys have got. That's it. Thank you to everybody for listening. We'll catch up with you next time. Cheers. Bye.